were often unreliable because of dust particles trapped inside. Even in top-secret factories, rubbish was found everywhere, and the slightest breeze blew the dirt resting on propaganda banners hanging on the wall onto sensitive equipment. The Americans doubt that we can make guided missiles because the Chinese are too dirty. Living conditions for workers were appalling. Stupendous imports of foreign machinery were meant to catapult the country forward, as gleaming new plants, from steel mills and cement kilns to oil refineries, were purchased from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. But very little was invested in the housing and feeding of ordinary workers and their families, despite the fact that the workforce exploded with the arrival of millions from the countryside. Take the iron and steel plant in Jinan, the capital of Shandong. Established at the height of the Great Leap Forward in 1958, with the most technologically advanced equipment, it should have been a haven for its new recruits. But conditions deteriorated rapidly. There were inadequate toilet facilities, so workers urinated and defecated directly on the factory floor. Filth and stench permeated the premises. Lice and scabies were common. Chaos reigned on the ground. Scuffles were a frequent occurrence. Windows were broken and doors smashed in. A pecking order emerged, in which the strongest workers grabbed the best beds in the dormitories. Fear was pervasive, in particular among women, who were commonly teased, humiliated, and abused by local carders in their offices, in their dormitories, or sometimes on the factory floor, in full view of other workers. None of them dared to sleep or to go out on their own. A similar scene could be found in Nanjing. When the Federation of Trade Unions looked into the lives of iron, steel, and coal workers in 1960, they found filthy canteens infected with insects and rodents. Queues were interminable, up to 1,000 workers lining up in front of a single canteen window at the Lingshan coal mine. As the canteen was open for only an hour, workers would tussle and wrangle for space, sometimes coming to blows. In the Guangtang coal mine, miners who were late were deprived of their meal and had to go down the shafts for a 10-hour shift on an empty stomach. Dormitories were cramped. On average, each worker had a space of 1 to 1.5 square meters, although some slept on boards jammed between beds or against the pillars. Many rested in shifts, having to share a bed. Straw roofs would leak, forcing some of the workers to move their bunk beds around the dripping pools. Others slept under an umbrella. Protective equipment was either lacking or wholly inadequate. Many miners had no shoes and had no alternative but to go down the shafts barefoot. Those made to hew coal in open pits were drenched when it rained, their jackets soaked with water. In the dormitories there were no blankets, and the humidity was so high that clothes would never quite dry. Some of the steel workers who had to work in front of blast furnaces burned their feet because they had no shoes. Further south, in subtropical Guangzhou, the dormitories were so crowded that a bunk bed provided no more than half a square meter per worker. Shoddy construction work meant that the premises were hot and damp during the rainy season, causing mold to spread like a rash, infecting clothes and bedding. The humidity was such that some of the facilities were described as mere ponds, with water dripping from the walls to form puddles on the floor. In the Kurun coal mine, located near Shaoguan, workers cannibalized the pit props and mine timber to build furniture or provide heating. 1 in 7 workers suffered from silicosis, also known as potter's rot, caused by inhalation of dust particles, as no protective masks were provided. The situation was no better in the north. In the capital itself, a detailed study of 4 factories by the Federation of Trade Unions showed that there were 4 times as many workers as before the Great Leap Forward, although dormitory space had failed to keep pace with the increase. In Changxingjian, in the Fengtai district, a railway factory allocated just over half a square meter to each of its workers. Throughout Beijing, Workers slept in storage rooms, libraries, and even in air shelters, often on bunk beds arranged in three layers. They were packed like sardines, so tightly that there was no room to turn at night. In order to get through a door, workers had to queue up. The toilets were permanently engaged and more often than not blocked. Many would wrap their feces in a sheet of newspaper and chuck the package through a window. Few factories provided sufficient heating. One of the four enterprises inspected had none in the bitterly cold winter of 1958-9. Workers would resort to burning coal balls in small stoves, which resulted in several deaths from coal gas poisoning. Influenza was common. Rubbish accumulated everywhere. Theft was widespread. Bullying was rife, in particular in the case of new arrivals. In the Liu Lihe cement plant, separately inspected by the Federation of Trade Unions in March 1959, three canteens designed for a total of 1,000 people had to provide for over 5,700 workers. Older workers were simply pushed aside by young men eager to jump the queue, many never eating anything but cold food. A year later, a similar investigation noted few changes, adding that hooliganism, a criminal offence taken from the Soviet Penal Code and covering a wide range of acts such as foul language, destruction of property, and illegal sexual behaviour, was common in dormitories. Workers used power and influence to upgrade from one bed to another, finding space for friends and family despite overcrowding. By 1961, up to half of the workforce in Beijing suffered from famine oedema. Industrial diseases were common, some 40,000 workers having been exposed to silicon dust. A report written by the city's People's Congress estimated that 1 in 10 workers suffered from a chronic disease. The real situation was probably much worse. Many new factories opened during the Great Leap Forward were described as run by the people rather than run by the state. They fared no better. Most were jerry-built affairs, quickly set up in buildings confiscated from the public and often inadequate for industrial production. One chemical workshop in Nanjing, put together in a residential dwelling, had a bamboo roof and paint peeling from mud walls. It employed some 275 workers. Radioactive waste permeated nooks and crannies, accumulated on the floor of the common room or lay in open vats, from where it would spread by wind and rain. Workers suffered from throat and nose irritations, as the protective equipment they were meant to wear was not used properly. The masks and gloves were often turned inside out and were carried to the dormitories without thorough cleansing. Of the 77 female workers medically inspected, 8 were pregnant or breastfeeding, although they were in contact with radioactive material for several hours daily. No showers were taken in the winter. This was not an isolated example. In the 28 factories run by the people in the Guluo district, the old centre of town where drums used to mark the night watches, rubbish was found everywhere. Ventilation was non-existent in the smaller concerns. Many of the workers were women who had joined during the Great Leap Forward. Most had no work experience and were given very little protective equipment, some only donning straw hats. Exposure to chemical components and silicon dust commonly caused red eyes, headaches, itches, and rashes. Some of the women had the cartilage separating their nostrils eaten away by constant inhalation of chemicals. Heat stroke, with temperatures near the furnaces ranging from 38 to 46 degrees Celsius, even in the middle of the winter, was a frequent occurrence. In a health check carried out on 450 women working in a factory producing electron tubes in Nanjing, more than a third suffered from lack of menstrual periods, a symptom of malnutrition. In the Nanjing chemical plant, a quarter had tuberculosis, while 1 in 2 suffered from low blood pressure. Half had worms. However abysmal their living conditions, workers were better off than the farmers who produced the food they ate. but few could afford to support their families or remit money to the village many had left behind. Their salaries were eroded by inflation and depleted by food purchases, necessary to complement the meagre rations they were given in the canteen. In the Shitsichuan Iron and Steel Company, workers spent 3/4 of their salaries on food. In Nanjing, many workers had to borrow money, incurring debts ranging from 30 to 200 yuan. Given the paltry salaries that most workers earned, these were crippling liabilities. A grade 3 worker made 43 yuan a month, although the food alone for a family of 5 cost 46 yuan. No savings were made in the canteen, where the fare was often poor and expensive. But few people ever managed to rise to a grade 3. The majority of salaries ranged from 12.7 to 22 yuan a month. In the more deprived factories, run by the people, over a third of the workforce were paid less than 10 yuan a month. Many had to borrow money or pawn the few personal items they had left, selling spare clothing during the summer only to shiver through the winter. And then came the medical fees, for which workers often had to pay. A close look at one chemical plant in Beijing in 1960 showed that hundreds of workers were in debt as a result of medical treatment. Chong Qingxian looked after his sick wife, but owed some 1,700 yuan by the time she died. He was taken to court and was required to pay 20 yuan each month, leaving him with just over 40 yuan to live on. He was an excellent worker, but many were in a less enviable position, ending up being ruined by the medical fees incurred to treat illnesses caused by appalling working conditions. When all the problems inherent in the planned economy were taken into account, uncontrolled capital spending, enormous wastage, defective products, transportation bottlenecks, woeful labour discipline, the performance of most factories was dismal. The actual costs were difficult to calculate in the financial morass created by central planning. Not only did accountants cook the books, but sometimes they did not even know how to handle the sums. In Nanjing, some 40 large production units had a total of only 14 accountants, of whom a mere 6 were able to keep track of the money. Many factories did not even maintain a log for outgoings and incomings, and nobody had the faintest idea of the costs incurred. But some approximations indicate the extent of the damage, as the example of steel, which is basically iron reinforced with carbon and hardening metals, shows. In Henan, 2.2 tons of iron were used to produce a ton of steel, meaning enormous waste. The cost of making a ton of steel was 1,226 yuan, which had to be sold at a state-mandated price of 250 yuan, or a loss of about 1,000 yuan per ton. In 1959, the province lost about 4 million yuan each month on steel. Better prepared to make steel in a cost-effective way were the technologically advanced mills and furnaces of Shitsichuan. Founded in 1957, Shitsichuan Iron and Steel made a profit before the Great Leap Forward, but soaring costs soon sent it plunging into the red. In 1958, a ton of steel cost 112 yuan, turning a profit for the plant of some 16 million yuan. In 1959, the cost per ton went up to 154 yuan, pushing the plant into a deficit of 23 million yuan, followed in 1960 by costs of 172 yuan per ton and losses in excess of 40 million yuan. By that time, the plant relied on a variety of poor iron ores coming from mines as far away as Hainan Island. As the losses started piling up, output collapsed. After several years of breakneck growth, the economy moved into a deep slump in 1961. The supply of coal, the fuel of modern industry, dried up. In the coal mines, the equipment had been so badly treated during the Great Leap Forward that most of it was defective. New machinery often did not last longer than 6 months, on account of the low-grade brittle steel used in its production. The miners themselves were leaving in droves, disgusted at the soaring cost of food and housing, fed up with the shortages of such basic items as soap, uniforms and rubber shoes. And even if the coal was hauled out of the mines, fuel shortages consigned much of it to pile up unused. The four big coal mines in Guangdong province produced some 1.7 million tons of coal in 1959, but managed to transport less than a million. In Gansu, the radical leadership of Zhang Zhongliang made sure that coal production soared from 1.5 million tons in 1958 to 7.3 million tons in 1960, at considerable human cost. But after the petrol ran out, some 2 million tons were abandoned in the mines. As coal production plummeted, factories around the country came to a standstill. In Shanghai in December 1960, the China machinery plant worked at a third of its capacity because of a lack of electricity. The number one cotton mill had 2,000 workers idle all day long. In the first half of 1961, the mandated amount of coal delivered to Shanghai was decreased by 15%, but a third of that reduced amount was never actually delivered. Close to half of all the iron and timber needed to feed the city's heavy industry was missing as well. Because it was an industrial center of strategic importance, Shanghai was given the highest priority by the planners. The situation was worse elsewhere, as the shortcomings of the economy spiraled out of control. In Shaoguan, the heavy industry city of Guangdong, a survey of 32 state enterprises in the summer of 1961 showed that production had nosedived, with soap down by 52% on the previous year, bricks by 53%, pig iron by 80%, matches by 36%, leather shoes by 65%. In the shoe factory, each worker produced one pair a day, where three had been made before the Great Leap Forward. These figures refer only to output, which more than doubled from 1957 to 1960, only to be halved again in the following 2 years. Had the cost of this obsession with quantity over quality been calculated, it would have pointed to a disaster of gargantuan proportions, inversely commensurate with the ambitions of the master plan. But no factories went bankrupt. That was a capitalist phenomenon associated with the boom and bust cycles that the planned economy was designed to avoid. Chapter 19. Trade. Many goods never reach the shops. The Bank of China calculated that some 300 million yuan was missing in Hunan in 1960 as a result of fake receipts, goods lost en route, sold on credit without permission, or simply misappropriated. That was just in one province. At a national level, the State Council estimated that some 7 billion yuan in funds was held that year by state factories instead of contributing to the circulation of goods. At every level of the distribution network, corruption and mismanagement took their share, nibbling away at the supply of goods that the plan had allocated to the people. When goods actually managed to leave the workshop floor, their first call was in a depot, where special storage companies accredited by the state sorted them according to their final destinations. In the storage and transportation company in Shanghai, hundreds of objects worth well over 100,000 yuan, telephones, refrigerators, medical equipment, cranes, accumulated in boxes because of sloppy paperwork, incorrect accounts, and illegible inventories. 100 vats of shrimp paste rotted outside in the rain for a month, the documents having gone astray and the company having forgotten all about them. But above all, goods vanished because the profit motive never quite disappeared. What was lost could be traded privately on the black market. Then there was the wait for a train or a lorry. China was a poor agrarian country that never had the capacity to send goods and supplies from one end of the realm to the other, and the flow was rapidly dislocated by a crumbling transportation system. As early as the end of 1958, the economy ground to a halt, and mountains of goods were heaped everywhere about stations and ports. Each day some 38,000 freight vehicles were required by the plan, but only 28,000 were available. Having inspected only the loading areas along the coast north of Shanghai, the planners found that 1 million tons of material was waiting for transport. Lack of equipment, spare parts, and fuel only made the situation worse over the next 3 years. By 1960, in Tianjin, Beijing, Hankou, Guangzhou, and other cities, goods entering the railway stations exceeded those leaving by an amount equivalent to 10,000 tons each and every day. Much of this was simply piled up in makeshift storage facilities, which reached 250,000 tons by mid-October. In Dalian, 70,000 tons of uncollected freight languished in the station, while hundreds of tons of expensive imported rubber had been lying around the port of Tsinghuangdao for 6 months. In the transportation hub of Zhengzhou, a ditch 6 meters deep was dug to dump goods, from cement bags to machinery. Much of it was damaged, a forlorn mound of bags and bundles, crates, barrels and drums. In Shanghai, by the summer of 1961, goods estimated to be worth 280 million yuan had accumulated in canteens, dormitories, and even on the streets, including 120 million meters of much-needed cotton. Much of the stock simply rotted or rusted away. Such was the breakdown in the transportation system that trains had to queue for their turn to enter a station. Both the tools and the manpower to move cargo were lacking. Brand new unloading equipment turned out to be defective, a problem compounded by the fact that 100,000 porters and haulers had hastily been made redundant to save on salaries. Logistics and coordination was not among the strengths of the planned economy. To this had to be added a lack of incentives and downright hunger. Engine drivers, normally pampered by the regime, had generally been entitled to a personal allowance of some 25 kilos of grain a month in the past, but this was lowered to 15 kilos. In Dahushan, Liaoning, the grain was substituted by sorghum or millet, while in Shichizhuang, Hebei, half of the monthly ration was delivered in sweet potatoes. Workers did the bare minimum, besides being weakened by poor diet. The mayhem also affected international shipping. Lost income as a consequence of chartered ships having to wait for days on end in the main ports of China alone amounted to £300,000. Local networks also collapsed. In Yunnan before 1958, more than 200,000 mules and donkeys carried food, clothes and supplies to the many villages tucked away in the mountains. They were replaced by horse carts, which grew from a mere 3,000 to well over 30,000. But horses cost far more in fodder, and they were badly managed by state enterprises, many dying during the famine. Cart horses, moreover, were ill-suited to negotiate the steep mountain paths and rugged landscapes of the southern province, leaving many of the small villages isolated. Lorries foundered. Yunnan was given only half the petrol it needed in 1960, and by September some 1,500 were running on alternative fuels, from charcoal to lignite, as well as sugarcane and ethanol. In Hunan, vegetable oil instead of machine oil was added to engines, causing widespread damage. Even in Shanghai, motorized rickshaws were taken off the streets, while many of the buses changed to gas, some of it carried in enormous improvised gunny bags rather than in cylinders. Neglect also undermined deliveries. The vehicle transport company in Guangzhou, for instance, boasted 40 cars, most of them acquired since the Great Leap Forward. Of these, three had already been ruined by 1961, while an average of 25 were in repair around the clock, leaving about a dozen in use. As the vehicles were pushed to the limit in the race to fulfill a faltering plan, the actual running costs increased. In 1957, by one estimate, a car cost just 2.2 yuan per 100 kilometres in spare parts and replacements, but 9.7 yuan by 1961. The main reason was constant use and poor maintenance. All manner of goods were delivered to the door in pre-revolutionary China, carried in baskets swung from a shoulder pole, carted on wheelbarrows, or occasionally in donkey panniers. Itinerant traders reached even isolated villages in the hinterland, carrying cloth, crockery, baskets, coal, toys, candy and nuts, as well as cigarettes, soap and lotions. In the cities, vendors thronged the streets, offering every possible item, from socks, handkerchiefs, towels and soap, to women's underwear. When hawkers and traders gathered at regular intervals at an agreed location in the countryside, a periodic market emerged. A multitude of farmers, craftsmen and traders, all with their goods on back or cart, swarmed into a silent hamlet which was transformed into a busy scene with wares sold by the wayside or displayed on temporary stalls. In the towns and cities, hundreds of boutiques, shops, bazaars and department stores competed for attention, from hatters, shoemakers and drapers to photographers, all mixing with fortune-tellers, magicians, acrobats and wrestlers to offer amusement and commerce. While traditional shops were low and open with the living quarters above, new department stores were towers of commerce, monuments of trade standing tall above the surrounding buildings. They could be found in every large city, illuminated at night with rows of electric lights, offering local and imported goods ranging from American canned sardines to child-sized motor cars. The striking contrast between the elaborate department stores and traditional single-story shops, often only next door, was typical of the diversity that ran through the whole structure of everyday life in the Republican era. Most of this busy, bustling world vanished after 1949. Free trade was replaced by a planned economy. Markets were closed down. Spontaneous gatherings were forbidden. Hawkers and peddlers were taken off the streets, often forced into collective enterprises controlled by the state. The itinerant trader and the once ubiquitous blacksmith became relics of the past. Department stores were nationalized, their steady supply of goods from all over the world drying up and being replaced by state-mandated goods produced in state-owned enterprises to be sold at state-mandated prices. The owners of small shops were forced to become government employees. Mikhail Klotchko remembered going to an obscure little store with hardly any goods at all in Beijing. He bought a pencil box out of pity for the one shopkeeper and his two sickly children. The only prosperous shops were near the tourist hotels in cities like Beijing and Shanghai, offering furs, enamelware, watches, jewellery, embroidered silk pictures of landscapes, and portraits of Marx, Engels, Lenin, and Mao. Called friendship stores, they were reserved for foreign visitors and elite party members. For ordinary people, the choice was dire. Take the example of Nanjing, a once flourishing city on the south bank of the Yangtze, which had served as the capital of the republic. Although the government clamped down on the free market, there were still well over 700 shops on the eve of the Great Leap Forward, selling their wares directly to the public. By 1961, a mere 130 had survived. Where a sophisticated network of manufacturers, traders and retailers had linked the city with some 70 counties and over 40 cities across the country, the advent of rigid collectivization led to a turning inward, as a mere 6 counties and 3 cities contributed to the local handicraft industry. As the plan replaced the market, the range of handicraft products halved to about 1,200. Even well-known heritage brands, from Golden Chicken hairpins to Yangtze River springlocks, buckled under the weight of the state. Variety in design suffered. Whereas some 130